You're listening to KDNK, and I'm Bill Kite, your host for Land's Sake. Today, our guest is Dee Malone. And Dee, if you could, welcome, first of all, and if you could, tell us a little bit about yourself here.
Well, thank you for asking me, Bill. It's a pleasure to be with you. I am Dee Malone, and I've lived in the Roaring Fork Valley for, almost 30 years now. I'm an ecologist. I work for the Colorado Natural Heritage Program, conducting surveys for rare plants and animals. But importantly for this discussion, I am the wildlife team chair for the Colorado chapter of the Sierra Club.
So you're a very busy person.
I like to be, yes.
Our topic today is wildlife management as it relates to land. And not everyone realizes that land management agencies, for instance, the Park Service and the BLM under the Department of Interior, and the Department of Agriculture's Forest Service do not manage wildlife on public land. That the management of wildlife is relegated to state agencies such as Colorado Parks and Wildlife. So that's what we want to talk about a little today, Dee, is that the CPW, as we call the Colorado Parks and Wildlife, has created quite a stir involving a controversial predator control program. How did we get to a place where the CPW is very much at odds with both the public and many scientists?
That's a great question, Bill, and it deserves a really in-depth answer. We have a lot of conflicting interests in Colorado, particularly as of late. In the last 10, 20 years, there's a lot of development with regard to energy. There's a lot of residential development. There's a lot of recreational development. And all of those uses, all of those human uses, aren't necessarily compatible with wildlife. Wildlife historically evolved with wide open spaces in Colorado. They evolved on landscapes that they could move across, that they could migrate through. During winter, they need to move down to lower elevation habitats. During summer, they need to move up into higher elevation breeding sites. And when we put houses and golf courses and drill pads and shopping centers and roads in their way, we get conflict. And so balancing those conflicts, balancing those uses, wildlife uses with human uses, is really, I think, at the heart of the problem here.
You know, I've worked in the past when I was with the Forest Service with a lot of really good people in CPW in the field. And they're dedicated employees. They care about the land and the wildlife. And they seem to be kind of caught in the middle here as far as I'm concerned. I would have liked to have had someone from CPW come here today, but they're under litigation for this very decision. And normally I understand I couldn't myself talk about anything when I was with the Forest Service that's under litigation. So I just want the listeners to know that we're not here to bash the CPW. We're here to try to explain to the public exactly what's going on here and why. So thank you for that answer very much. You know, I think too, those of us who buy hunting licenses know that that money goes towards funding the CPW. And this issue to me, I could be wrong, but this issue to me is about how we need to increase the deer population so we can have more hunting licenses. Well, whether that's right or wrong, isn't there a better way to really fund the CPW?
Well, hopefully there is, because as you described, the bulk of CPW's funding comes from hunting licenses. So if the herd, if the deer herd or the elk herd start to decline, then their revenue starts to decline and their ability to manage the lands and the wildlife that they're in charge of also declines. So they're caught in a bit of a conundrum. And expanding their funding base is ideally the way to go, because then they can give more importance to non-game wildlife. And they do have a program that speaks to supporting and protecting non-game wildlife species. But truly, because their revenue comes from hunting licenses primarily, that's where they need to pay most of their attention. So they're caught in a bit of a trial here.
And I understand that mule deer population is being, sort of not what it used to be. When I first came here in 1984, I remember the winter before that, was such a heavy snowfall winter that the deer had a real hard problem just surviving. And I was in the field, I would see a carcass every half acre, every acre. It was amazing how much the kill was on that particular winter. And so, you know, I understand what's at stake here. But it also seems to me that we're testing a theory here to hear the official version. And with so much opposition, why aren't they listening to the public and knowledgeable scientists?
That's another great question. What the bulk of the science is demonstrating and what the vast majority of the scientists are supporting is the science that has demonstrated that, number one, winter range for mule deer is the limiting factor. So winter range is critical. And winter range is critical because that's where the deer are struggling. So the nutrition on that winter range is what keeps those mule deer going. If we lose the winter range, then we lose the mule deer. And that is what most of the scientists have described in Wyoming, in Nevada, in South Dakota, in North Dakota, in Montana, all around the West, and in Colorado. Let's not forget Colorado, because there's been a huge amount of really good science, a lot of it conducted by CPW itself, that demonstrates that it is the winter range that is critical to mule deer survival. And indeed, a study conducted in 2016, just this last year, by CPW, documented that 2.5 million acres of mule deer winter range has been lost between 1980 and 2010. And commensurate with that loss of 2.5 million acres in Colorado of mule deer winter range, there's been a decline of what they call the recruits, the early winter recruits. So the deer that are 8 to 10 months old, there's been a commensurate decline in that particular population of mule deer, that age group, of 23%. Now, that's not causation. They can't show causation, but what they have shown is that winter range is critical and that the nutrition on that winter range is critical. What the research has said in that report just this past year is that likely it's the residential and energy development in mule deer winter range that has caused the decline. So we're really looking at changes in habitat, changes in the availability of the deer to get to their habitat that they need to get to, the quality of that habitat. Basically we're talking about sage.
Right.
If the sage has been decimated by too many livestock, or if it's been overbrowsed by too many elk, because our elk population is enormous, 280,000 elk.
Right.
If they're competing with livestock and with elk and with energy development and with golf courses that have gotten rid of the sage, we just can't support as many deer.
Right. So it's a very complicated issue rather than just having a theory to test to see if the predators are contributing to this decline. It seems to me that, you know, people also build in places that are actually the winter range of these animals. And people move here wanting to escape where they came from, but yet they bring everything with them that they came here with. In other words, they don't understand that wildlife lived where they now live, and so you're going to have those conflicts, and then they want the CPW to fix the conflict, especially with bear. And we know people are ignorant and leave their trash out overnight, and it creates a pattern for bear, and so then we got a problem. It's a human problem. I've discussed this before on the show. So what's the solution then? Why are we trying a rather primitive method of predator control at this time? Is that, you know, the only arrow in their quiver? What's going on?
Let me say also that you mentioned about predator control and that it be somewhat primitive, and I would say unequivocally yes. the science has shown us in all the states surrounding us and in Colorado that predators, and in this case, we're calling predators, we're saying that they're lion and they're bear is what they're focused on for this particular study, that they take a very small number of ungulates of deer or of elk. And in fact, when the CPW did a recent study of predator impacts down near Salida, they showed that lions took about 6% of the adult mule deer that had been collared and took about 7% of the fawns that had been collared. It's a very small number.
Right.
When predators in other studies have been heavily controlled, in studies in Wyoming and in the Dakotas, basically all of the researchers have said that predators do not have an additive mortality effect. In other words, predators are primarily focusing on taking animals that would have died anyway, that would have died because they're weak. So when fawns, these 8 to 10 month old fawns, go into winter and they're in a weakened condition because there's not enough nutrition, those fawns become more vulnerable to predators. Those are the critters. Those are the fawns that the predators are focusing on.
Right.
So we've shown that pretty clearly. What CPW has also demonstrated by their own studies is that when they improve sage habitat, the mule deer herds also improve. So improving habitat by restoring the range, by really being careful about where we allow development, by maintaining migratory corridors, by trying to restore fragmented areas, in other words, restore the connections between habitats that enables those mule deer to move, to provide them the protected landscapes that they need to survive. So we can start by thinking about restoring habitat and restoring connections. It's more difficult, yes, but in the long run, you're going to get a sustainable long-term effect.
Great. I appreciate that. It's not an easy answer, is it?
It's not an easy answer.
For those of you just tuned in, you're listening to KDNK, and this is For Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host, and today we have Dee Malone, a wildlife biologist, with us discussing a recent decision by the Colorado Parks and Wildlife to start, I guess is the best way to put it, predator control in two areas of Colorado, the Piance Basin and along Arkansas, I believe. So let's talk a little bit about what happens when agencies like CPW don't listen to the public. If I recall, years ago, we had a ballot question that passed that allowed people instead of biologists to have their say in the bear population and doing away with the spring bear hunt. And I personally have, as a hunter, have seen the increase in bear as a result of that into the wildland-urban interface, so to speak, where that wildlife habitat is against where houses and human beings are. So I really don't want to see that happen again because it's not the way to manage wildlife. Do you see something like that happening as a result of the dissatisfaction over this issue?
Well, with regard to the bear issue, the bear populations in a natural setting, not at the urban wildland interface, because that's not a natural setting at all.
Right.
Wild bears, pretty much as they always have over evolutionary time, stay in a pretty dynamic balance with their food supply. So if their food supply declines, then bear reproduction declines and the bear population declines. When the food supply goes up, reproduction is successful and the bear population goes up. So when we get to the wildland-urban interface, now we've got this false food supply because now we've got a food supply that's high all of the time. So those urban bears are a different story altogether. So we've got to be a little bit careful in describing what we're talking about. There's been some really good study here, even in the Roaring Fork Valley, just a few years ago, by a woman by the name of Sharon Barak-Morodo, who did some radio collaring of bears and tracking of bears, and in essence discovered that urban bears are urban bears and wildland bears are wildland bears, and the wildland bears may occasionally move into the urban wildland interface, but they pretty much stay in the wild. So we've got two separate populations that we're talking about. So I don't think that we're going to experience that same sort of issue.
Okay. And I remember reading that that article, and it also, I thought, mentioned that there are a lot more bears than were thought populating Colorado. Is that correct as well?
Again, it's complicated.
Right.
And I like to use the phrase, and I don't know who said this, but ecology is not like rocket science. It's much more complex.
All right, I like that. Okay.
So the bear population is not stable. It is a mirror of the ecosystem. So again, when the food supply declines, whether it's due to a poor berry crop or a poor acorn crop or a short winter, they come out of hibernation too early, there's no food around, natural bear populations are going to respond to the food supply. It's when we get these towns in the middle of what used to be natural areas that are going to skew that story, because we are supplying bears with food. So we've artificially inflated their population. And so we're bearing the fruit of that. And so then CPW has to come in, and they're in the midst of this conflict, which really is not a fair conflict.
Right.
Because they're trying to manage wild populations, but we've got humans that just got dumped into this mix. So they're sort of stuck.
They are, and it's a shame because they have a tough enough job as it is. I know when they tag a bear and it gets that second strike and they have to put it down, they're not happy about that. They didn't sign up to do their job to be wiping out bears and because of human problems, and I realize that. You know, the thing, too, that I'd like to talk about is bear are included in the predator control. I think it's bear and what else is it?
Bear and lion.
Bear and lion. And I don't know what the lion population is like. I don't know if it's considered to be a healthy population right now, if the numbers are in good numbers or what the deal is there. How do you feel about controlling lions this way?
Well, one of the problems that you just alluded to was that CPW does not have a good grasp of what the lion population in Colorado is. So when you put out an arbitrary number of a certain percent or a certain number of lions that you're going to include in the harvest, they don't really know how that's going to impact the lion population. Importantly, in Colorado, there is no regulation against taking females.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They suggest to not take females, but it's somewhat difficult to distinguish between males and females. That being said, historically, about 40% of the lions that are killed are females. If you think about the idea that about 70% of a female adult lion's life is consumed with taking care of young. In other words, 70% of a female's life, she has young with her. If she is killed, that means that her young, which are likely stashed away in a cave somewhere, in a root ball somewhere, are also going to die.
Right.
So when you're killing lions, you're not just killing the adult. You may very well be killing the young also. Also important in the lion part, adult lions manage their territory. They don't allow young lions in. So when you kill an adult lion in a particular territory, that territory is vacant, and young lions are going to move in because now the adult is gone. That sets off what a lot of the researchers, a lot of the lion researchers have called chaos, because the young lions move in, they're sort of establishing their territory. They end up actually taking down more deer and more prey than the adult did, because they're young, they're like juvenile delinquents, and they kind of go into this state of chaos. So killing lions basically sets into motion this very disruptive process in ecosystems.
And I used to use the term ecosystem management because we have big egos thinking that we can manage a little portion of the ecosystem here and then it's not going to affect the rest of the ecosystem. And it's really hard to play God like that. So it's a rough job as it is. I'd like to talk a little bit with the time we have left about the wolf reintroduction in Colorado. Could you give us a brief sort of history about where we are and the difference between the wolves that are in Yellowstone and the Mexican wolves that were being planned on reintroducing them here in Colorado, but that's not going to happen apparently.
That's a big topic, Bill, but I'll go really quickly. So historically, Colorado was this really marvelous mixing ground of various subspecies of wolves. We had wolves coming down and in Colorado from the northern Rockies. We had wolves coming up into Colorado. The genetic evidence shows us that we had wolves from New Mexico and Arizona and Mexico, the Mexican gray wolf moving up into Colorado. We had the plains wolf coming onto the Front Range of Colorado. So Colorado was really this hub of wildlife activity. As you know, by the mid-1940s, wolves had been completely extirpated from Colorado, primarily at the behest of the livestock industry, because of what they viewed was excessive predation on livestock. Wolves were removed from most of the West, and in 1995, after an absence of many decades, gray wolves were restored to Yellowstone National Park and the Northern Rockies.
Right.
Those wolves genetically would be the same wolf genetically that we saw in Colorado and would be the same wolf that we would bring and restore to Colorado. Most of the wolf biologists agree that it is very unlikely that wolves will move across Wyoming through the Red Desert, across the energy development, and through everything, and establish an ecologically effective population in Colorado. Very unlikely to occur. And that's why the Sierra Club and many groups, the Defenders of Wildlife, Turner Endangered Species Fund, we're all working together to bring wolves back to Colorado in an active restoration effort. So your other part of the question, why not let Mexican gray wolves move back up into Colorado?
Right.
Well, four governors, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah, wrote Sally Jewell, the previous Secretary of the Interior, a letter in opposition of any Mexican gray wolf moving north of where they currently exist. Currently, Mexican gray wolves are relocated to habitat below I-40,
okay,
which moves east-west across Arizona and New Mexico. If they move above I-40, they're darted and brought back. That's not that they don't want to go there. The habitat is perfect for them up into Colorado, up into the Grand Canyon, up into Durango and down in that area. Habitat, that's exactly where they want to be, particularly with a changing climate. They want to move up into those mountains. But according to the law, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the EPA, they cannot move where they would like to move.
Again, it's all because of human beings, isn't it?
That it is.
We have a way of limiting wildlife where even they used to have their historic range. In the last few minutes of the show, what can the public do when these kind of situations develop where something unpopular happens in the range of managing, trying to manage the wildlife?
The best thing that every single person can do if wildlife is important to you is to get involved in the management. The public has a right. This is our wildlife. Wildlife is part of the public trust. And as part of the public trust, we have a right to be intimately involved in what occurs, not just for this generation, but for future generations. So get involved, you know, whether it's Sierra Club or Defenders, go to our websites. We are actively and always, particularly in this political climate, involved in these issues. So please do get involved. Let your voice be heard. Become a wildlife hero.
I like that. That's a perfect place to end. I wish we had a lot more time because these issues are not simple. They're very complicated. And I really enjoyed you explaining to us exactly what's at stake here. And thank you very much for coming today, Dee.
Bill, it was absolutely a pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. This is your host, Bill Kite, hoping that you do on Mother Earth what you do for land's sake. Join us again on March 14th here at KDNK at 4:30.